We'll hear argument now in the case of United States against Jackson.
Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the Court, my name is Thomas Janczewski, and I represent Appellant Victor Jackson in this matter. This Court issued two significant decisions in the case United States versus York that were not respected at the trial court in this case. First, the Court held that drug code testimony is appropriate for expert testimony under Rule 701 and 702. And then second, this court admonished trial courts to take special precaution when the court and a litigant introduces both lay testimony and expert testimony through the same witness at the same visit to the witness stand.
But in this case, of course, the witness is a participant in the offense. Doesn't that make a difference?
Your Honor, the witness was, I guess it depends on how you define participant, but the witness was an informant for
participant in the conversation.
A participant in the conversation.
Yeah. He's explaining, I mean, he's saying this is what was said, and I heard it, I understood it.
Your Honor, he's certainly permitted to say this is what was said.
Why can't he testify that when you say, you know, banana, I think of a yellow fruit? Or not necessarily.
Well, Your Honor, I think that circles back to the rules of relevancy, and he is permitted to testify to things that would be within the common understanding of your untrained lay person. But his testimony is only relevant to the extent that his interpretation of what Jackson thought was accurate. If it was mistaken, it's not relevant because it doesn't tend to show the truth or the falseness of Jackson's statements.
Yeah,
why is that question of expert testimony? Suppose somebody says, you know, suppose somebody from India says, when we were speaking Hindi, and we were speaking this dialect of Hindi, right? And the jurors wouldn't know that it was a particular dialect of Hindi, but the participant in the conversation says, this is what we're doing, and this tells you what the words mean. Is that expert testimony or fact testimony by somebody who's a participant?
Your Honor, I believe that would be that's addressed by Rule 604, which in the version of the rules of evidence in existence at the time of this trial also cross-referenced back to the 702.
So what would you do with this situation? There's a conversation going on, and somebody says, you'll find the drugs in the boot. And actually, it happens to be a British person
right.
who's saying it. And so they mean in the trunk of the car. They don't mean inside a garment that you would wear when it's rainy or snowy.
Yeah.
And so they say, when I said the boot, I meant the trunk of the car.
That's an interesting hypothetical, and I don't know if I have a precise answer.
But what happens here, in a sense, he's saying we're using something that we both understood that the boot means the trunk, except now these are zips and, you know.
Your Honor, I agree. He testifies that we both understood that this means X. But it doesn't matter what Kaiser thought X meant. The only thing that's relevant in this case is what Jackson thought. And so there must be some tendency for Kaiser's testimony to be correct, because if it's incorrect, this isn't, for example, self-defense, where even an incorrect belief or incorrect understanding of someone else's words is itself relevant. It's only to the extent that Kaiser's testimony is correct that it's relevant. And to answer that, you have to go back to, well, what is it that supplies that tendency for Kaiser's testimony to be correct? If it relies upon information and knowledge that is available to the untrained layperson, then yes, it's lay testimony. But under United States versus Kahn and in a series of cases after that, if it's outside the understanding of a layperson, That's specialized knowledge, and that must be introduced through Rule 702.
But as a transactional witness, he's entitled to testify to the terms of the deal. He's not just testifying as a decoder, which might be expert testimony in the nature that our prior cases have distinguished case agents who are listening in on conversations and then translating for the jury what the coded language means in the drug trade. That's not at all what's going on here. He's a transactional witness who's giving testimony about what the terms of the deal were and what they meant and what the
Your Honor,
intended by the language that they used.
And, Your Honor, I would not quarrel if all he did was say, I went in and Mr. Jackson offered to sell me narcotics and I accepted. But that's not what happened. What happened was the jury was presented with the recording, presented with the transcript, and the testimony was elicited. What does this mean? What does hype mean? Well, hype means a clucker. Okay, well, what is a clucker? And it's not even necessarily all of his testimony are not necessarily words that were used within the context of the conversation, and certainly the drug code testimony is only a portion of the testimony. He also testified to the manufacture of crack cocaine from powder cocaine, the market prices of crack cocaine in the Champaign area, the quantities of crack cocaine that a dealer would purchase versus the quantities of crack cocaine that a user would purchase. And the drug code language is really the only thing that the government challenges here. But certainly we would argue that this other testimony, I struggle to see how that is anything but expert testimony.
Is there any harm to this, given the recordings and the rest? What's the problem?
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand the problem, but I mean, is it the kind of problem that should be addressed on appellate review?
Yes, Your Honor, I think you're calling raising the issue of the standard of review here, which is plain error.
Right.
It was not objected to.
Tough.
I certainly understand that. The first question, obviously, is whether it's obvious, and we would argue that, you know, one of the things we haven't talked about yet is the starting point, which is the plain language of Rule 701C, which says anything based upon scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge within the scope of Rule 702. And as Judge Easterbrook instructed earlier, the drafting history is only relevant to the extent that that's ambiguous, but if someone were to say that's ambiguous, the drafting history certainly sets forth that drug code testimony and drug trafficking testimony is appropriate for expert testimony. And then also, if you look at the way that the government used this testimony, it was not a small part of the case. A read through the closing arguments will show that it was pretty central to the government's case.
How would one go about qualifying a confidential informant as an expert witness?
Your Honor, I suppose you would ask him his experience, the type of it's a fair question. The record here doesn't reveal that our confidential informant, or not ours, but the confidential informant in this case, had ever bought or sold crack cocaine ever before, even once. Now, we all assume he does, but I don't think that assumption is founded. I don't think we should assume that, well, he looks like a drug dealer. He seems like a bad guy. He's got some criminal history. He probably knows about crack cocaine. There should be something in the record that actually supports the idea that he does. And then to go back to the plain error issue, this wasn't an open and shut case. Recall there were three counts here, and Mr. Jackson was acquitted on count three. And the difference between count three and counts one and two is there was no recording. So, you know, as we look at the evidence, we don't know exactly what it was, what aspect of that recording was what made the difference, but some aspect of the recording made a difference. And you know, we would argue that absent Kaiser's testimony, this transcript is indecipherable and incomprehensible to your typical juror. And that's what ultimately made the difference in this case. And certainly if you, again, to go back to the government's the comments in closing, the government says, you heard the testimony or you heard these you heard this recording and you saw the transcripts and you heard Kaiser tell you what these words mean, explain to you what these words mean. Kaiser's testimony was important. And then if I could just draw the court's attention, there are some sentencing issues before the court as well. One of them simply rises and falls with the Supreme Court, we would argue.
Dorsey will be decided sometime in the next 3 weeks. We are all eagerly awaiting the Supreme Court's disposition.
And then we have a final argument about the crack disparity. But there's really not much to say about that unless the court has any
Thank
questions.
You, Counselor. Mr. Hartzler.
Good morning. I got it. Thank you very much. May it please the Court, Joe Hartzler on behalf of the United States. Regarding the harmlessness of this testimony, I'd like to begin with focusing on why we have a plain error standard, and it's because there was no objection. There are several very good reasons that defense counsel wouldn't object to this testimony, and one, of course, is that it's not all that harmful. If you review the cross-examination, you'll see that defense counsel doesn't address the Kaiser testimony or interpretation of the remarks during the recorded conversations whatsoever.
Now, if there had been an objection, was the government prepared to put somebody else on to talk about how to cook crack out of powder and what the prevailing prices were in the area and those kinds of things?
I don't know if the government had designated an expert to do that or notified defense counsel prior to the trial. Typically, we file a witness list, and I don't recall that they would have done that. I wouldn't be surprised that if there had been an objection and it had been sustained, which I think would have been unusual under these circumstances with a transactional witness, I wouldn't be surprised that the judge would allow the government to supplement its witness statement or list of witnesses, pardon me, and then, I mean, you've seen plenty of transcripts in other trials where we call DEA agent Glenn Haas or various other people to testify as to how crack is manufactured or meth is manufactured, what the street prices are and things of that sort. So, we're in the range of speculation here, but there's little doubt in my mind that had Mr. Kaiser been not permitted to testify as to some of these minor details, the government easily could have called probably the case agent could have testified as an expert to those things. But, I mean, there really isn't much outside of the interpretation of words such as, when Mr. Kaiser asked Mr. Jackson what's the price for a 63, and he says, Mr. Jackson responds with a question, on the barbecue side or soft? I mean, I think the jurors probably didn't need an interpretation to know that they weren't talking about spare ribs there. And Mr. Kaiser said...
Depends on the price.
Yeah.
63 spare ribs. Well, those sorts of things, I think, were the...
They're cluckers, zips, O's, which for some reason are grams, not ounces.
Right, yes.
Sure about that, but
those are in the context of the conversation between Mr. Kaiser and Mr. Jackson. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what did Mr. Kaiser understand him to be talking about? The zips is the best example because it comes up so regularly throughout the conversation, and he explains what he understood them to be talking about. Zips. Just so I don't forget, can I mention one other thing that counsel just said that this was a close case because there was an acquittal on count 3. That's not right at all. There was a hung jury on count 3. For all we know, it was 11-1 in favor of conviction. The count was dismissed, I believe, at sentencing.
The count where the recording device failed?
That's the one where there was a malfunction. Correct. Right. Right. But it was not an acquittal. I mean, I think it's unfair to say this was a close case. I mean, this was an informant that testified, revealed all of his warts and problems and baggage that he brought to it, had the recordings, had decent surveillance, and they got him on the two counts. Oh, I should also add, notice on the count two, if you look through the transcript, you'll see there's an April 23rd transaction, that's the count one, and the defense to that one is Mr. Kelly, the co-defendant, set this up. And then there's a defense to count three, which is April 28th, which is it's not recorded and you can't rely on Kaiser. So what's the defense to the middle count, count two? That's the transaction on April 26th. When that's the transaction in which there's a conversation about on the barbecue side or saw. What's the defense? You look through? Ignore it. That's the defense. I mean, essentially he attacks Kaiser, he being defense counsel, attacks Kaiser and his credibility. And I guess you could say that's the argument. I also wanted to mention in terms of the harmlessness of this testimony and why there wouldn't be an objection that the defense was really don't believe Kaiser. So the more responsibility defense counsel can place on Kaiser, the greater the possibility is that he can raise some kind of doubt in the minds of the jurors, which is exactly what he tried to do in opening statement, in closing argument. So it's far better to have someone like Kaiser testifying to some of this information than to have the case agent or an expert from DEA come in. So he said in closing argument, he being defense counsel, said to the jury. So ask yourself, if you have a doubt, start with a proposition of just a doubt between Kaiser, between poor video, between I don't know what the lingo is, and I'm not sure I can trust one side or the other what the lingo is. But essentially what he's trying to do is to say, you've got to rely on Kaiser to convict on all three of these counts, and Kaiser is not a dependable witness. If there are no other questions about this question of expert, oh, by the way, I love the hypothetical about the boot, but can you imagine if you had a baseball scandal, a baseball bribery case where he had an informant and the conversation was, yeah, we'll pay you $500 to boot a grounder. And the informant couldn't testify that boot a grounder means to, you know, miss or muff the ground ball. I think the transactional witness is really the key to this. The transactional witness can interpret what the conversation means, not just in the drug area, and I don't see the application of York to this conversation. I just want to mention finally that I would urge the court to address
much baseball lingo is actually similar to Hindi. It shares that with much ERISA lingo.
I hope you're joking. I assume so. The third issue is a sentencing issue. And you'll notice that it was not preserved. Indeed, it was waived. This is problematic, I think, for the government and for district courts. The process is for the probation office to issue an initial or preliminary pre-sentence report that doesn't go to the court. It's not in the record. This court, I do not believe, will see the initial PSR. And then the parties send in letters contacting and making their objections. Those letters are not part of the record. The letter is not part of the record here. So the argument that's being made was based on an objection made in the letter, but not made at trial, not preserved in the pre-sentence report. The pre-sentence report has three objections.
But the government knew about it. I mean, it's not like
I'm not doubting the government knew about it. We know about it. Yeah, we're not surprised. I'm surprised that it comes up on appeal is my point. Why would this be addressed in district court if it's not raised in district court? There would be absolutely no reason for the district court. This is my point. So from now on, when we get a letter such as this, it lists a number of objections that aren't carried into the PSR and aren't repeated at sentencing, we now have to address those and ask the judge, by the way, defense doesn't raise this objection, but we would like you to address this objection. Why? I would hope the court would consider that whole issue waived. Not just forfeited.
Why would it be waived? I certainly understand a forfeiture argument, but why waiver?
Because he was asked at sentencing, do you have any more objections? There were seven, I think, in the letter. Seven objections in the letter.
Right, but that's not what waiver is. Waiver is an intentional relinquishment of a known right.
And how is this?
And if somebody says, I have no more objections because the person's head is empty
right.
and can't think of objections, presumably he's forfeiting those objections, not waiving them.
And the government gets the benefit of plain error, so the government's not over a barrel. How many plain error cases do you lose?
Fair enough.
Okay.
Either way, I guess I'm only concerned because it puts the district court in an awkward position if it hasn't received the letter and asks, what are your objections, and there are three listed. I think it's unfair to expect the district court to address that one that wasn't even mentioned.
Didn't the defense counsel's statement in response to the court's inquiry, however, go beyond, nothing further, Your Honor, and affirmatively represent that the defense was limiting its arguments to the three that were raised before the court? I mean, isn't that what counsel said?
It's in our brief. I can either take a moment or I just don't recall exactly what the language was.
I understood that it really was more in the nature of affirmative waiver language rather than I can't think of anything else now, Judge. And maybe I'm misremembering it.
Well, the one thing I do recall is that Mr. Jackson obviously limited his defense counsel in terms of what he could say at sentencing. It was
a little bit ambiguous because it's the PSR addendum that says that all but three of the objections in the letter were either resolved or withdrawn. And it's not defense counsel actually standing there and saying that. It's one step removed. So I think that's probably what you're thinking.
We can look it up.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yes. Waiver, forfeiture. Whether it's plain error or waived, I believe that we prevail on that issue. If there are no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Case is taken under advisement.